This is New Books in Journalism, the show where we talk about the latest works in journalism, media, and communication. I'm Dave Schwartz from the University of Iowa School of Journalism and Mass Communication. Today we hear from Brian Michael Goss, author of Rebooting the Herman and Chomsky Propaganda Model for the 21st Century. Goss's work reconsiders the legendary model in a present-day context using a series of case studies as his framework. Before we get going on the book, Rebooting the Herman and Chomsky Propaganda Model in the 21st Century, just tell us a little bit about your background and your research.
Sure. Well, I work at St. Louis University. I've been here since 2001. I got my PhD from the University of Illinois at Urbana, and my concentration there is politics and media, so this book is very squarely within that. But more generally, I work within the domain of mass media. So the main channels of media that I deal with are film and journalism. And that seems rather incongruous insofar as films are, you know, baldly fictional, just about the vast majority of them. And then on the other hand, you have newspaper discourses, and they're supposed to be truthful. Nonetheless, I mean, the overarching concern, you know, with regard to my teaching, with regard to my research, is mass media. And the preeminent specialty that I have is critical approaches to journalism. And there's been some spinoff too. I've written things about blogs, about political cartoons, and such. But what you have in this book is quite central to the interests that I've been pursuing and exploring, going back into the 90s and my training as a graduate student.
So it's been 25 years or so since Edward Herman and Noam Chomsky came up with their model, and then the famous manufacturing consent. Why now is it time to reconsider and maybe reboot their model? What about the current climate inspired you to revisit this work?
Okay, well, I think, you know, there's two directions where that is concerned. I mean, one is you have a larger external world and the conditions that prevail within it, as well as, you know, what I'm doing as a writer. Well, where the first is concerned, the model was published in 1988. So if you read the book, I mean, a lot of their examples are drawn from the 1980s, things like the surrogate attacks on Nicaragua, for instance, being a big part of that book. And in the time since then, there's several things that have changed in the world of considerable importance. One is that it's no longer the Cold War, no longer the bipolar logics that governed the way in which the world was running for a long period after World War II, two generations roughly, almost a half a century. And also within this domain of what's going on in the external world, there has been what's sometimes referred to as the communications revolution. Well, when I was in graduate school, we even were able to joke about this at the time. At the start of our training, first part of the 90s, what was construed as new media was cable television, the VCR. So by the end of the decade, terrain was very different where that is concerned. And clearly, we're still all getting our heads around what it is that's different, what it is that are the possibilities and the limitations as concerns new media. So those are two very important things. I mean, one is the political climate is very different from the fact that the Soviet Union is no longer in business, if you will, and also the rise of new media as well. So these are things that demand some investigation. So, you know, that didn't start in 2011, roughly when I started writing the book, but nonetheless, enough distance to try and assess how these are playing out as they intersect with the model. The other thing is, you know, why was I writing it? Well, it was also the book Manufacturing Consent that you referred to is one that had considerable impact on me. When I read it, I was actually a graduate student in another discipline, experimental psychology. I was working with things like electroencephalograms, and I was so struck by the book that in short order, I changed my PhD program. So this is something, a book that's had a considerable impact on me, Manufacturing Consent and the Propaganda Model. But I do feel like the intersection of time and place was such that I could finally address this in a book-length fashion. So that was the other dimension of this book. I mean, both the external world as well as my own situation that brought me to composing it.
And that's interesting. So it sounds like there was a little bit of a personal element as well. This is the book that drove you into a different graduate program.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, you know, any kind of like work that people do along these lines and some investment of themselves in it. I mean, you know, you're spending a lot of time geeking away, doing the reading and you know, reading things 15 times and so on. So, you know, I mean, there's always that, you know, which is in play with it and some kind of extension of yourself that's at stake in that. But, you know, the other thing is you want to reach readers, you want to inform people. Indeed, coming back to manufacturing consent, I mean, that's the impact that it had on me, was, you know, I went into another discipline. The thing that I was dedicating myself to studying shifted after I read the book and in very short order as well.
Now, one, I mean, you mentioned, you know, a number of the ways in which the climate and the industry and many things have changed since the original work came out. One of them I want to touch on now is how the industry has just become so globalized. And, you know, Herman and Chomsky were very much, it was very much an American-centric, or maybe, you know, and there was some Western European, some British model as well. How did you go about addressing the new global nature of media?
Okay, well, one thing that's different, you know, as concerns the way in which I conduct the case studies. And, you know, the original book, you know, it's mainly devoted to case studies. I mean, it's the first chapter that lays out the filters that are endemic into the in the propaganda model. And thereafter, they pursue case studies. I actually do more with respect to talking about those filters. Hence, the way in which the book is organized is a large part of it is called contexts. And how far does that extend? Well, I'm holding a copy of the book here right now. And that's the first 90 pages of the book is devoted to, in some ways, detailing the filters themselves. And then starting page 93 through the balance of the book, go into the case studies of this. Now, one of those case studies is British media, and in particular, the riots that convulsed England and London particularly about 2 years ago in the summer of 2011. So, yeah, that is very clearly a move where very self-consciously I wanted to take the model and try to expand it outward geographically. With respect to talking about the riots, I talked about them in terms of the us and them filter, the binarization that occurs in the news narratives that Chomsky and Herman also allude to, although I, you know, also retrofit the filter in some measure as well. So that's one of the ways in which I try to, you know, make the book have more of a global perspective, because their original, yes, I mean, is very strongly grounded in the performance of U.S. news media, albeit U.S. news media talking about events from around the world. But nonetheless, a lot of emphasis on the New York Times, in Chomsky in particular, in his long corpus of work. Now, in that section of the book called Context as well, in terms of talking about media ownership, that necessarily brings in its train talking about the degree to which the larger firms are also internationalizing as well. And one that's the most clear example of that, and particularly as concerns news media, is News Corp, Murdoch's company, that is to say. It started in Australia, moved in short order, you know, mainly in the 70s and 80s to a large base in the United Kingdom, and very clearly a prominent part of the landscape in the U.S. now, notably Fox News being one of their holdings. So, you know, that's very clearly a company that, by design, or at least in practice, has expanded itself quite strikingly across the English-speaking world, also with considerable interest in penetrating further into Asia as well. So in all these respects, you know, self-consciously, I was trying to bring on board more international perspectives in terms of applying the model, also considering the political economy of news as well, with News Corp referred to quite a lot in the course of the text.
Great. So I want to talk a little bit about the structure of the book, and you brought it up, the idea of putting the contexts first. And going back and looking at the original manufacturing consent and the five filters, When you're in the planning stages of this book, and I know things, you know, sort of evolve as you get into them, how did you go about, you know, wanting to, you know, address and look at, you know, the original five filters versus, you know, and then structure it with the, I'm sort of stumbling over my own words here, you know, and then, you know, I guess addressing the old first and then, you know, saying to where we are, going to where we are now, and then, you know, gradually moving into the case studies.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, with regard to talking about the original model, you know, there was a need to engage in some retrofitting, to use that term that's used in the book. I just used it a moment ago as well. And I think perhaps the most obvious place where that arose was, again, they were writing in the 1980s, and they're not soothsayers, they're not psychics, they're not standing in the shoes of Nostradamus or something along these lines. So they didn't realize, in short order, just a couple of years after the book was published, Soviet Union, the Eastern Bloc, was going to collapse. So they did put a lot of emphasis, and rightly so, given the climate of the time, on the Cold War, on the anti-communism filter. Now, that doesn't really maintain so well now. There are people who still talk about communism, or more specifically anti-communism, accuracy in media. AIM, you know, they're a good example of this. I mean, they're really quite prehistoric with regard to that. But in large measure, the discourse has moved on from that. Hence, you know, that's where I had to do the most work with respect to patching together new filters, or a new filter in this case that I call us and them. Now, in doing some revisiting of the model, I mean, you know, they've talked about anti-extremism and so on, but I wanted to try to put the, that filter into the most abstracted, into the most generalized framework. And that I took to be us and them, you know, the differentiation of you know, what characterizes us, our goals, our actions in the world, and them from whom we are taken to be differentiated and distinct. And that also, you know, applies with regard to our allies versus you know, people who see it as enemies as well. So that's some of the work that had to be done with regard to taking the original model and you know, doing some updating on it. And you know, I went, rather than going more specific, I went to more generalized and more abstract. I think that was the most important change. But also, you know, the over the past quarter century, it's not been, you know, some kind of inert environment. Flack, for instance, which, if you read the original you know, opening chapter of Manufacturing Consent, Flack, they deal with kind of more of an afterthought. I mean, they have, I'm sure, more to say about it, but they tended to kind of treat it as a more minor filter. I'm actually much more interested in Flack, in part because this new media environment has actually, I'm positing, gone a long way toward intensifying the production of Flack. What do I mean by this? Well, it's Dan Gilmore, who is one of the more strong advocates of new media. He wrote the book called We the Media. And what he said in this book was, he was quoting someone else, but what he said in this book was, it's one of the main points he has, with the advent of new media, we can fact check your ass. We can fact check your ass, is what he says. That's true. So when somebody in media says something that's wrong, they can get fact checked by all of these people who are, you know, hooked up to their computers and so on. But what also happens is we can harass your ass as well. You know, we can generate, have that many more channels to engage in sometimes contentious or tendentious or false kinds of discourses about what somebody has said as well. And a lot of that amounts to flat. So that's something that I'm you know, also very interested in, but it's treated in a more, you know, as being a more minor kind of filter in you know, the original 1988 formulation. So I put more emphasis on it, and indeed, I mean, it's something I want to, you know, investigate and explore more in the future as well, as Flack. But it's a very interesting topic, that is to say. So again, that was less doing retrofitting as concerns the original model, more a matter of stress and emphasis as well. Because I think, you know, Flack is something that is really appreciated in the years since they published the original model. Just to finish this answer somewhat long, you know, just the other day, Liz Cheney announced that she's going to run in the primaries for Senate from Wyoming. against the incumbent, which, of course, is an uphill fight. But what was striking was, you know, if you go by Dan Gilmore, we can fact-check your ass. People would be, you know, more likely just to speak the truth if they're going to get fact-checked, you know, from all different directions. From what I've read of her announcement, which is actually videotaped, if she put it up on YouTube, as I recall, she was, like, launching one fib after another. One falsehood after another. Things like the White House was directing the IRS in terms of their reviews of different organizations. So she's not afraid, it would seem to me, of having her arse fact-checked where this is concerned. These are some of the ways in which new media is not played out in the way in which people expected that it would on this score. And new media being something that has also been instrumentalized for the purposes of generating and intensifying more fun. So that's those are some of the considerations that went into how do you take the filter and start applying it to the case studies and also reworking the filter as necessary for the contemporary moment.
Sure, and I want to get into one of those case studies, the one of the New York Times account of the Bush administration in the UN and leading up to the 2003 invasion. Using those updated filters, and please take your time with this answer because I'm really fascinated by what you're going to say. How did you apply these updated filters to that particular case study, and what did you learn?
Sure. Well, that's something that in some form or another I've written about different moments within that story leading up to the invasion of Iraq previously. Not anything as, you know, such sustained attention as that dedicated chapter of the topic, but I pulled off bits and pieces of it in various other kinds of scholarship, you know, different articles that I've written as well. Now, in this case, however, I do think that it was more the old-fashioned aspects of the propaganda model that came to bear on that. Most notably, sourcing. That is to say that in terms of the people whom the New York Times consulted with respect to getting the quotations, the backgrounders, the facts, the interpretations of events, they stayed very tightly within an elite circle in doing so. So consequently, one of the more striking parts and more, really aggravating aspects of the discourse in the Times was when administration officials made assertions about the legal basis from invading Iraq, saying we already have the justifications from the United Nations that we need in hand. It's already been voted on, Resolution 1493, and so on and so forth. And these are things that were just straightforwardly false, and they could have consulted lawyers who would have been able to tell them this in short order. But the main thing that I saw going on there was with regard to where were they getting their information that was shaping the news narratives. It was the oxygen on which these news narratives were living. And it was, from officialdom almost entirely across the board, with a heavy measure of emphasis on administration officials as well, who are often taken as, having the final word. I mean, these were objective reporters, of course, and they do cite people with some differing views. But, it's also the case that they tended strongly to come around to what the administration sources said as well. Now, by contrast, in the chapter I mentioned, there was like one article out of more than 100 that I found from early 2003 where, they actually subject the administration claims to some kind of scrutiny. The article was Burns' article about the alleged drone. Now, the Iraqis said that this was something to do with agricultural surveillance, and the administration, including the State Department, was positing this was some kind of dangerous weapon. Well, Burns, the reporter, actually looked at the drone, determined that, it was made out of wood, that it had tape holding parts of it together, that it seemed to have what the Iraqis were stating as being a radius of 10 or 12 kilometers in which it could operate. And Burns' article is rather statement. He's saying that, here we have this fact sheet from the State Department, and here I'm looking at the thing itself, and these things are from different universes. But that was a very rare instance. In fact, that was the single most clear instance where the reporter, just didn't take what sources were saying, but actually tried to adjudicate what is true and found the administration claims to be highly lacking. Well, they could have been doing that all the time, and they weren't. That is the baseline point. The information was out there. And it's really embarrassing to say this. It is truly embarrassing to take note of this. The very nasty government of Iraq at that period of time was telling the truth to a greater extent than Bush and the people around him. Let that sink in for a moment. Let that sink in. The seedy dictatorship was actually achieving a level of truth not seen in the Beltway. Now, that's remarkable. The reporters could have gone far further in that direction with respect to cross-examining their sources. Okay, so that was a pretty straightforward application of the sourcing filter. The other one that was in play there, too, is the us and them filter. Okay, what about that? Well, it's not a surprise to me that U.S. news media is going to be wedded to viewpoints that come out of the U.S. I mean, it would be strange if they weren't. I mean, this is just a fundamental way in which people behave. But nonetheless, in covering these stories from abroad, particularly this one, or ones that implicate invasion or international aggression that are at stake within it. In those instances, these us-them kind of discourses, whereby you highlight the assumption that you're always right, that your leaders are far-reaching visionaries and so on. In these instances, that tendency toward us and them leads to places such as the disasters that were engendered in invading Iraq, partly for the U.S. and mainly for the people there, by the way. So again, that's one of the other things that I saw as a concomitant of this us-them filter, was reporters and even people who were steeped in and trained in the objective methodologies, engaging in some instances in these almost embarrassing kinds of sycophantic discourses about the head of the government in the U.S. This, in some ways, being symmetrical with the degree of denigration of Iraq's leadership. Well, nasty guy, nasty regime. But that does not bring in its train this symmetry, this assumption that we're led by these total warriors, these people of untrammeled truth and such. So, yeah, I thought that was one of the manifestations of us and them on that score. And with the result of less scrutiny, less investigation of the truth value of the comments, discussions, backgrounders that people in Washington are giving. So that's, I think, how the filters play out with regard to that chapter and with regard to the discourse in 2003 in anticipation of invading Iraq.
And sticking with – there's the us, them. Sticking with just the us for a second.
Sure.
You mentioned there's some different applications of the term us. How does the term us apply toward the media and the relationship toward its ownership and toward its advertisers and funding? And not so much an us, them in terms of us, America, them, Soviet Union, but in terms of us, who butters our bread.
Right. Well, that I don't address that very often. Just a couple words about us and them too. I mean, this is a concept I've worked with quite a lot. As I mentioned, my area is mass media. Something I wrote pretty recently was about a TV show. I used to watch as a kid, by the way. It was already in syndication, but Mission Impossible. Do you remember the show?
Of course, yes.
Yeah, I mean, the TV show, so it's a lot different than the films. But again, I mean, how did us and them play out in that? Well, the agents, they never used violence. They used simulations. They would, do a chop to the back of the neck, but, they didn't shoot people. They didn't engage in, violent behavior. But they did. That was one of the things that differentiated us and them. We used simulation cleverness, outsmarting in this this chess game of espionage, whereas they're coercive. They're the violent ones. Now, what you're saying about that other way in which us and them might play out with regard to thinking about the political economy, well, that the media is not very self-reflexive on that score. The Kurtz, the chapter that deals with Kurtz, Howard Kurtz, mm-hmm. brings this up as well. I mean, he talks about the different discourses people engage in, but says very little about the industry itself. Another contrast to that I can think of, and rather surprisingly, comes from just a couple days ago in the International Herald Tribune, which is, of course, the international arm of the New York Times. And, you know, it's very widely available here in Madrid. So I'm writing about this presently. And over this past weekend, they had an article, I thought a very erudite one, from someone in Turkey. And what he was claiming was, in Turkey, the problem that we have is that we have a very strongly privatized media system. Never mentions the U.S., but of course, you can say much the same about the U.S. And the problem is that there's no, you know, heavy-handed censorship that is really vexing our media system. Rather, it's the complicity between the state and the upper reaches of the private sector. People who have a lot at stake in different regulations and allow them to own more or cross-ownership or things along these lines. That's what he was saying was really stifling, was the private censorship. The way in which not just, through chilling effects, but even, firing people if they're not going along with the line of the private sector and, in particular, its moguls with very large stakes in expanding out their ownership. So, again, that might be construed as us with regard to the newspaper industry, but it very seldom gets covered. And in this case, in the International Herald Tribune, I'd be utterly shocked if they published something like that about the U.S. News media, about the extent to which a country where the laws are very enabling as concerns journalism, nonetheless has such constraint with respect to where journalists go. But they do publish the article about how this plays out in Turkey. A case I know less about, but what he was saying is very familiar from investigating and examining U.S. news media and the way in which the private sector also, clearly does some very good journalism, but also has its commitments and its ways of circumscribing and subjectifying its reporters such that they go in some directions, not others, or only so far in given directions. One of those is not to explore very much about their political economy in which they themselves work.
Sure. I had there's a faculty member here who said that, the key to producing a book that can really get some traction is about 90% hard work and research and writing and talent, and 10% just that right kick of a little bit of luck. And so I was fascinated when you were going into Kurtz that you also contrasted him with Glenn Greenwald.
Okay.
Who just timing-wise could not have been more perfect for your book, his involvement in Eric Snowden and everything else. And if you could, just describe that how you played those two, sort of off each other, Kurtz and Glenn Greenwald, in terms of their approaches to, traditional and then sort of maybe the new practices of media.
Sure, yeah. And you're right as well. Greenwald is in some measure becoming a news story in himself as well. But that's something that had the germs of an idea of making that contrast for some period of time. It happens to fit very squarely into what the book is about. And what I was proposing the book to Peter Lang, that's what the reviewer suggested as well, was more attention to new media above and beyond this. Wanted to put in a chapter that, to cover it throughout the book. But where Greenwald is concerned, I've been reading his blog for some time, I think, somewhere since about, say, 2007. I wouldn't say, that I'm fully in register with everything he says. He's much more of a libertarian, I believe, than I identify myself as being. I wouldn't call myself a libertarian, but very clearly that's the base of his thoughts about his training as a lawyer, about the law, as well as more generally as well. But this is concerned again. If you're going to do a case study, you want to have some kind of contrast, and certainly in their discourses, the contrast is really stark as well. And the other thing is, you don't want to pick on writers or media organs that are really not very highly respected to begin with.
Sure.
And in the case of Kurtz, you have somebody who's recognized as being, and there's a lot of quotations that I marshal out to evidence this, somebody considered to be the pinnacle of self-reflexive media criticism from within the mainstream media. But nonetheless, you can see the extent to which Greenwald, and he does it very self-consciously, I think, as well, plays out the extent to which he's trying to puncture all of these points on which mainstream media agrees. And I think perhaps the most basic obvious is the extent to which people, by the time they rise to very high levels in different professions, oftentimes internalize a lot of the prejudices and assumptions of those organizations. In the case of news media, and Greenwald's not the only person who's said or implied this, that's what I heard again, his ethnography from some decades ago also has a lot of evidence along these lines. But what happens with these regard to these people who reach the top of the profession in journalism is they often start to see themselves as being people in very close proximity in many respects to the people whom they're covering. People at the commanding heights of the state and the private sector are the same people who live basically up the street from them, who, their kids know each other and things along these lines. So they have a cast of mind, a way of looking out and gazing upon the world that has many of the same assumptions embedded within. So that's a lot of what Greenwald is saying. There's a lot of what he tries to puncture as well as concerns his media critiques, the extent to which news media, particularly at its most elite and most high profile, most prestige manifestations, has really become an annex of these elite people, this elite class. Perhaps the subjugated sector of that class, but nonetheless, part and parcel to it. That's where they position themselves. It's not out of, malevolence toward other people. It's just a very, organic question of, what their paycheck is, where they live, who they associate with, and all that comes along with that in terms of sculpting a person in depth. So again, that's, with Bourdieu and William Grider, these are some of the people who I also bring on board, with testimony in terms of that these claims. So, so where that is concerned, again, it's a very strong contrast that you get between Kurtz and Greenwald, between new media and old media with regard to how they reflect on media performance itself.
So we're starting to wind down. I do have just a couple of more questions. One, with this, there's this, talk of new media or internet media sort of being this revolutionary type of populist type of deal. But, with the propaganda model also being rebooted in these times, how does the propaganda model, how do we roll it back to help see, the new media really reach the potential that some people see it being able to reach?
Yeah, I mean, on this score, we talked about Greenwald a moment ago. Greenwald started out, I think it was in 2005, and he had started off 30 readers of his blog, and I think more of the stress then was on legal issues, particularly things concerning, things he's working on presently as well, surveillance. He got linked to by some other blogs, and within short order, within about a week, he was up to 30,000 readers. This is according to Eric Bullard's account of Greenwald's trajectory on the score. So clearly, this is something that didn't happen in the past with regard to somebody being able to command an audience and even very substantial audiences in a short order after putting out their shingle as a commentator. And Greenwald is not a whole newspaper on himself, but he's quite prodigious. For a large part of the past decade, he's writing 1,000-2,000 words per day as well. Very substantial kind of interventions, that's to say. But still not a newspaper on to himself. And that's one of the points that I make in the book as well. So a lot of the successful bloggers from the previous decade, a lot of the successful entities, the longer they stick around, the more they start to get absorbed by or morph into more conventional mainstream media. The case of Greenwald, he went to an internet daily salon. Now he's with on the platform of the London-based Guardian. Or something like Talking Points Menu. Talking Points Memo. I don't say much about that, but it's become more of a conventional kind of web page, kind of a daily bulletin with a number of people writing for it, and so on. So Well, this is concerned. I mean, the question is, how is new media going to help to subvert the propaganda model? Well, part of the evidence that I cite is that it's not doing that at all, that reporters are actually getting overworked because they now have a bigger news role to fill, so that new media in some ways is actually accelerating the capture of news production within the orbit of the propaganda model. So I don't think it's technology, you know, really, that is going to be a savior on this score. Rather, you know, I think what is needed is, well, more reporters. Reporters now are very well trained, that is. When I was at University of Illinois, the kind of rigor of the training of the journalists was indeed very impressive. William Grider, or I should say it's Lance Bennett, one of the best critics of journalism, the way she phrases it is that journalists are better trained than they ever were. And this is certainly squares with my observation as well. But we need more of them. As it stands, working in private sector media, you know, the number of reporters working on papers, on news organizations, is much less than it was even a few years ago. So they have fewer reporters and they're filling a bigger news hole as concerns, and this bigger news hole has been occasioned by new media. So that's a very straightforward one. More reporters are needed. I think also in terms of upsetting the propaganda model, we need, I think, to shift the emphasis from objectivity reporting to telling the truth. And these are not the same thing. Objectivity means that two people said two different things and you report them both. The job is done. Well, no, it isn't. Not with respect to the truth. Because one of those people might not be telling the truth. Or one of them might have a greater, you know, purchase on the truth, greater truth value than the other does. And that's what reporters should be concerned with, is a positive. Finding out, ascertaining what the truth is, and not just stopping with the methodology, the technique of objectivity, which in a lot of respects can, you know, be quite corrosive to the telling of the truth. Now, there are instances where, you know, objectivity does, you know, work the way in which it's envisioned of working, but also consider, too, that you know, people who are unscrupulous political operators, knowing that they're facing objective reporters, in fact, it incentivizes saying things that aren't true or they're very slippery. Because, you know, their claims are going to get handled probably in the even-handed way that the objectivity doctrine demands, that will allow them to get away with it, or at least for some period of time. You know, we, of course, you know, timeliness is very important where this is concerned. So, yeah, I'd like to see truth being enthroned, and not the technique of objectivity would be another way of pushing back against the propaganda model. So, yeah, those are two very basic things. You know, what is the objective reporting? Truth is what it should be. And more reporters as well, which also might be more news organizations on top of that as well. Indeed, as I've noted, private sector news sometimes, you know, produces very good news performance. It's also the case that, you know, living here in Europe, you see that there's a much stronger tradition of public media. Now, media that's funded by the state, you know, if you have a very dysfunctional state, of course, you have the possibility that that news media is going to be nothing more than another arm of the state. But in countries that have mature institutions, like Western Europe, like the U.S., you can also expect that if you have news organizations, you give them the funds, and then you'd allow professional people to run those organizations and be hands-off where that is concerned. And you don't have that in the U.S. I mean, you know, we'll give money to state universities like University of Iowa for professional people to run the organization. And, you know, it's not like the governor, like, dictates what's on the syllabus or something like this. Nobody would could imagine such a happening. And that's how it should be with media. State can give the money. You have more competition where this is concerned, more points of view in circulation, but, you know, staying out of the content of it. And, you know, with that's concerned, you look at the BBC. I mean, it's one of the – well, they've had scandals recently with regard to bad behavior, egregious behavior by some of their presenters who, you know, were actually predatory. But in terms of its presence and its news gathering, it's one of the best projections that Britain has outside of its territory. and it's state-funded news. And that's how they basically do it. They get the money, and then professionals run the organization. They don't become mouthpieces of the parties or the prime minister. So these are some ways in which news performance can be improved in some very straightforward ways and push back against the propaganda model.
So where do you go from here? What's next for your work and your research?
Well, the book, was substantially finished about a year ago. In August, I was finishing it up. The Kurtz and Greenwald chapter was the last one that I was writing before we started classes. And then, during the fall, I was shortening the book. I had to, it hadn't fit in with the contractual arrangement of so many words. And then you have to format it. That was about the spring. So again, it's kind of a long gestation where that is concerned. So what did I do when it was all finished and the book came out last month? Well, I started writing about Spanish films, horror films like Rec, which is a well-known horror film from Spain. I started writing about that director, Juan Pellegrino. And I'm right now been invited to write something about Pedro Navarro, which I'm just finishing. And the other thing I'm working on concurrently is what I mentioned, International Herald Tribune. So what about that? Well, it's the New York Times International arm. And how would I describe it? Well, there's a lot of us and them there. Let me just tell you a story. I think I might, when I write this up and send it off to a journal, I might start off with this one. But you might know that last summer, in order to raise his profile as an international statesman, Willard Mitt Romney, let's call him by his real name, he was doing his international tour. And he went to Britain and he started saying things that very straightforwardly were construed as insulting. As to say, I don't know if the Olympics are going to go off, these kind of things. Because it was right before the Olympic Games, and he was voicing some doubt that they could actually get them up and going and so on. Well, this is very badly received in Britain, as you might expect. The thing I'm positing is that the International Herald Tribune does this every day. Every day they spend many pages pointing out all the corruption, all the ineptitude, all the bozo clownishness, all of the ungovernability in every other part of the world. But in the U.S., it's very different. The parties might, they have different points of view, but they come together. They craft out agreements. They hammer out the laws. That's what we do. But you don't find that elsewhere. Well, I'm being a little bit glib when I say that, but nonetheless, this us and them very strongly guides their news narratives. Well, it's easy to say that, but the point is that, thus far I've accumulated a body of about 200,000 words, about 200 articles, and I've got to start shaping it into the article, and that's going to be at the base of it. There's evidence in that claim that us and them very strongly drives how it is that IHT, International Herald Tribune, conjures up this external world for its readers. And in doing so, again, this us and them necessarily, them are never as good as we are.
Well, the book is Rebooting the Herman and Chomsky Propaganda Model in the 21st Century. The author is Brian Michael Goss. Professor Goss, thank you for joining us.
Okay, my pleasure.
You've been listening to New Books in Journalism, part of the New Books Network. You can find Rebooting the Herman and Chomsky Propaganda Model, written by Brian Michael Goss, at Amazon and other retailers. Thanks for listening.